1 week later. C plus 11. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. The following Sunday evening, GSC Chairman William Godfrey quietly announced that the summit in Buenos Aires was being extended by a few more days. He presented this as a positive development, stressing that unprecedented cooperative progress has already been made in several key areas. The great relief in both Birchwood and Buenos Aires was that the public remained unaware of just what those key areas were. This was one secret Dan McCarthy had no qualms about keeping from anyone, for he understood perfectly well that public order could break down almost immediately if the news broke in the wrong way. Chaos was not conducive to progress, as he understood just as well, and as such, it was paramount that fast-tracked efforts to prevent or mitigate Il Diavolo's impact with Earth could get underway while the world's economic and social structures remained functional. A handful of developments from the summit had filtered down via Timo's Fiori Frontieri delegation, which included Dan's friend Alessandro Bonucci, as well as several planetary defense experts from Timo's facility in South Africa. But there was so far nothing tangible. Dan couldn't be sure whether Alessandro's external communications were being monitored and that he thus had to measure his words, or whether there were simply no major breakthroughs to report. He hoped beyond hope that it was the former, but Timo didn't seem to share his optimism. The whole week had felt like something of a purgatorial twilight zone for Dan. Some news commentators drew inevitable parallels between the GSC summit and the UN summit of the previous year, at which world leaders had convened to discuss how to deal with the apparent threat or warning suggested by the crosshairs-like symbol which intersected Earth on the first two plaques. There was one obvious similarity in the simple fact that leaders and scientists were once again gathering to establish a common response to a threat discovered on an alien plaque. The main difference in Dan's mind was that this time, the threat was real. And this time, although precious few knew that the comet had been discovered, thanks to a plaque at all, the engravings which led to its discovery truly were alien. Global media personnel camped outside of the GSC compound in Buenos Aires in fewer numbers than they had outside of the United Nations building in New York, largely because they didn't understand the true enormity of what was really being discussed inside. National representatives were forbidden from leaving the compound and forbidden from participating in open interviews with any reporters. In this regard, there were parallels between the summit and the previous year's highly secretive initial analysis of the first two alien plaques, which also occurred in Argentina. In that instance, the nature of the international team's analysis had been public knowledge, but their location had been kept secret to avoid invasive media attention. The reverse was true in this instance, when everyone in the loop knew that every ear and every eyeball around the world would have been obsessively and disruptively focused on Buenos Aires had the real reason for the summit been disclosed. But the real reason wasn't public knowledge, and for this reason, life largely went on as normal. The anti-GSC protests which filled the streets outside the compound were now no more than memories. And each passing day's social media meta-analysis graphs clearly showed that previously acute fears over potentially imminent threats from space were fading and fading and fading. The immediate aftermath of the California fireball had been a period marked by borderline hysteria. But as pages were ripped off the days since a major celestial event calendar and the number of days without incident rose, people began to consider that perhaps the rapid-fire trio of events which began with a bolide at Kerguelen and continued with an unexpected satellite re-entry in Montana was just that, a trio. After California, eyes around the world had been trained to the sky in trepidation. Now, hindsight was beginning to make a majority of people realize that their palpable dread had been an unwarranted, if understandable, overreaction. It helped that the signatories of the infamous Kerguelen memo had publicly climbed down from their initial analysis of the bolide as observably unnatural. Needless to say, the level and nature of the persuasive pressure those individuals faced was not a matter of public record. The main media story from the summit had been a credible bomb threat on the third day, which led to a full evacuation of the GSC's headquarters and halted the time-sensitive proceedings for an entire afternoon. Unsurprisingly to most, responsibility was claimed by the so-called welcomers, a group whose numbers were inexplicably growing and whose focus was on sabotaging all Earth-defending measures in an effort to ensure that the scourge of the human virus, as they saw it, would be eradicated when the external universe saw fit. "Why can't those assholes just do a mass suicide like what happened at Hemshaw last year?" Clark had asked angrily when he saw this news. "If humans are so bad and should be eliminated, why don't they start with number one?" No one had offered any kind of argument or defense on behalf of the odious welcomers, whose chief skill seemed to be uniting the rest of the world against them. The week's edition of Focus 2020 briefly touched on the issue of the welcomers and their ever-growing zeal, but in general the episode was illustrative of the fading fears over celestial threats, as only one of its two segments focused on the summit, while the other was devoted to a completely unrelated trade deal, which President Slater had recently managed to hammer out. Every few hours, the irony slapped Dan in the face like a sea lion's flipper. Just when public fears over space-based threats were dropping towards pre-Kerguelen levels, the greatest threat humanity had ever faced was drawing inexorably closer by the day. If the purgatory-like week of silence did anything, it vindicated Dan's long-held belief that big power really could keep big secrets. For years, naysayers had told him that there could be no alien cover-up because the human beings involved in it would slip up before long. His ability to say, "I told you so," had died when he learned that Richard Walker's cover-up was in fact an elaborate hoax. But the fact that at least a few hundred high-ranking politicians and scientists around the world now knew about Il Diavolo proved once and for all that an alien cover-up could have been kept under wraps. The comet wasn't exactly water-cooler talk at the GSC. Only those who had appropriate clearance and worked in relevant departments were in the loop. But the national leaders of all the GSC's primary member states were also in on the secret, and between those leaders and their inner circles of advisors, the numbers quickly added up. He shared this point with Emma in a lighthearted way, and her reply was that the situations weren't really as similar as Dan thought. In this case, everyone understood that keeping the comet secret, for a while at least, was an objective necessity. In short, people really were being kept in the dark for their own good. That wouldn't necessarily have been the case with aliens, she said, since that secret, leaking out, wouldn't have inevitably led to immediate global disorder and chaos, which could very plausibly reach anarchic proportions within days. Having received their first payment from Timo, the Feather Brothers in Salida had relieved everyone by keeping perfectly quiet about the fourth plaque. Needless to say, the Feathers still had no idea what was engraved on the plaque found in their late father's hoard, let alone what kind of discovery its engraving had led to. Clark, meanwhile, had gone to work on 5 of the last 6 days. His nose still didn't look right after its run-in with an invisible wall at Richard Walker's house, but the aching pains in his ribs had more or less disappeared. While Dan admiringly wondered how Clark could focus on anything, Clark wondered how Dan didn't go crazy doing nothing. Emma also worked remotely with a few high-paying clients over the course of the week, shut away in her home office and trying to keep her mind off things just like Clark was. Timo spent his days in Dan's basement, liaising nonstop with his staff around the world, some of whom were exploring highly theoretical solutions to the comet problem. His regular presence prompted Henry to inquire one day about what was really going on and why Timo was hanging around all the time. Henry didn't mind, but he wanted to know. Timo satisfied his curiosity with a spur-of-the-moment reply that his presence at the Gravesen Hotel in Colorado Springs had been reported and widely circulated, that public knowledge of which suite he was staying in invalidated his insurance coverage, and that he would be out of Henry's hair as soon as he sourced a long-term home near his soon-to-open Fiori Frontieri headquarters at the old IDA building. Henry bought the white lie and insisted that he wasn't trying to force him out. Timo was more evasive when Henry asked a less expected question. "So, is something finally going on with those two?" Timo pretended not to know that those two referred to Emma and Dan, and he shrugged as convincingly as he could when Henry clarified the question. Henry didn't buy this answer quite as readily as he'd bought the first. Henry also belatedly became aware of Rooster's presence next door, prompting the group to stick to the previous year's story, that he belonged to Emma's aunt, with an additional line that he was now there for good. Having been out of the picture during Rooster's previous brief stay in Birchwood, Henry expressed his surprise that the dog was a Cocker Spaniel and insisted that someone had told him he was a Labrador. No one knew where Henry had gotten this idea from, and he eventually accepted that he must have misremembered. Dan and Tara kept each other sane, largely by competing endlessly at a newly viral mobile game, which was supposedly based on an old Russian card game. The app had taken social media by storm, thanks to its simplicity and addictiveness following a big-budget TV campaign featuring none other than the movie star Caitlin Judd. They both spent more money than they realized on in-app purchases, but all things considered, it was a small price to pay for the amount of time the game filled. When Dan's eyes widened as he saw the total cost of his purchases, Tara quipped that it was barely any more than she'd normally spent managing her virtual farm in the course of an average weekend. When Dan saw Timo in the mornings and evenings, they tended to talk about nothing but the comet. Dan and Emma, on the other hand, barely talked about it at all. Both seemed to understand that it was important to insulate themselves as a couple from external stresses that would have torn most apart. Tara's presence was a benefit in this regard, too, as she insistently steered discussion to any other topic whenever Il Diavolo cropped up, as it inevitably did from time to time. Emma worked very late on Sunday night, firefighting on behalf of a regular client who had stepped on a social media landmine with some poorly worded comments about how his firm's recent charitable endeavors had provided $1 million exposure for a tenth of the price of traditional marketing. When she finally left her office in the early hours of Monday morning to find Dan and Tara still playing their stupid game on the couch, an exhausted Emma squeezed in between them and fell asleep on Dan's shoulder within minutes. None of them could have imagined that just a few more minutes later, the calm would be over and the storm would begin.